speak on ethics and faith. I'm Mary Carlson, and each of us will introduce ourselves briefly. I'm currently an assistant professor of social work at St. Olaf College. I have a long-standing interest in biomedical ethics in particular, primarily from a professional point of view. I was a medical social worker for many years in hospitals, served on a number of ethics committees, and I'm currently consulting to the Northville Hospital Ethics Committee. One of our goals for this week is that we all feel as though we're ethicists at some level. I'm no expert, probably no more expert than many of you in the room, so we welcome everybody's participation.
And I'm Dan Spencer. I'm currently a graduate student in Christian Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And prior to that, I've been there for about 3 years. Prior to that, I was at the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, where much of my work involved taking church groups and human rights groups to Latin America to look at issues of social justice and faith, human rights in that region. And so while my primary area of study is ethics, the actual material that we're going to be working on this week together, I don't have as much experience in it as Mary does, but I do bring some training in ethics and sensitivity to some of the larger issues of social justice and society when we look at ethics. And so just as a footnote to that too, Mary and I have known each other for about 10 years now, and we're housemates for about 3 of those, and always wanted to have an opportunity to teach together. This is the first time we've ever done it, so we're really looking forward to working with each other as well as working with all of you this week and going through this series on ethics.
I paid him for the footnote. That was nice. Just a couple comments about the week, what our approach is going to be. Today is going to be primarily some introductory information about ethics and biomedical ethics in particular. We will probably talk more at you today than we ever will during the week, although we always ask for participation, particularly today for clarification and questions. Our goal is to develop some common language in the area of ethics. Our belief is that all of us will be faced, if we have not already been faced, with ethical dilemmas in our lifetimes. And it would be nice if we would be able to consult with each other now, ideally ahead of time, before we face some of these very difficult life decisions, and use some common language that is familiar to both professional ethicists and we hope eventually with common lay people that most of us are. We've mentioned that the emphasis is primarily biomedical ethics that comes out of my professional experience. Always talking about, however, a faith perspective and what that brings to our discussion and understanding of ethical dilemmas. So we're going to do a quick start with some brainstorming about where you all are with ethics, what you think about ethics. I'm going to do some writing on the board. We ask your participation for a couple minutes.
If I were to simply lay the question out to you, what is ethics? What are some of the responses that you would have off the top of your hand, either brainstorm fashion or more thought out answers? But if someone said to you, what is ethics, how would you respond?
What is right?
What is right?
Yes. Keep going, I'll find something.
Maybe moral guidelines?
Moral guidelines.
Fairness, honesty.
Fairness, honesty. Anything else that comes to mind?
Choosing the least wrong.
Okay, choosing the least wrong. Sometimes talk about that as the lesser of two evils.
Group morality.
Group morality. Group morality. Having something to do with communities or groups. Anything from the balcony up there?
Does patriotism fit in?
Patriotism, we can certainly put in there. It has to do with values. And we'll come back and talk about that some more this week. How about if I turn the question slightly and said, who does ethics and why? Who does ethics?
Everybody.
Everybody. When you say everybody, what expand on it on that?
Just in her preface. At some point in your life, you're going to have a dilemma on your hands, whether you want them or not.
Okay. Some point, all of us are going to be faced with areas or questions or choices that will bring in the whole area of what is right, the ethical decision of what to do, that's what is right, or as someone else said, what's least wrong. We may be faced with a situation where there's no perfect response, but we still have to make decisions about that.
I'd say everybody, but that we're faced every day
many times, or often many times a day with what's right for them.
What was the last part you said?
Well, I would say everybody, but not just that sometime in our lives we'll be faced with moral decisions, but that we are every day faced with moral decisions.
So something just about the way we interact with each other has an ethical dimension in everyday life. Yeah. All right.
So philosophy or ideology.
Okay, philosophy or ideology. This is a sense that there may be a formal system to the way ethics is done.
I would say both culture and the church have a great deal to say about what is ethical.
Okay, so sources that for doing our ethics include both culture and the church, in terms of both of those areas have been involved in formulating what's ethical.
I would say only moral people.
Expand on that a little bit. You say only moral.
Adolf Hitler was not a moral person. He did not do ethics. That excludes everybody. Okay. Only moral people can do ethical things.
Okay, so some connection between morality and ethics, certainly. And whether we want to talk about good ethics and bad ethics, or simply say that all ethics is necessarily good, but that there's some, again, that moral sense of what is right in there. This is just a lot to build on, and I think it already shows up. One of the things that Mary was talking about that is a working assumption of the two of us and working with you, and that is that we all are involved in doing ethics, although we may not always name it that or recognize it that. And we're all involved in doing it in both of the ways that came up. So at those certain times in our lives when we're faced with a particular crisis that forces us to reflect deeply on something and think about the ethics involved. Most of us have had occasions to do that, or will have occasions at some time in our life to do that. But we're also involved every day in the way we interact with people, in thinking ethically and coming up with how our values and how our commitments shape the way we interact with people. And so both of those are going to be the kind of working assumptions that guide our discussions, building on the experience that we already all have in putting our values into actions and helping them shape the choices we make. What we would like to do today, and as Mary mentioned, we're going to do a fair amount of talking because we want to lay out an overall framework. Someone mentioned the sense of ethics being a philosophy or a framework for doing these things, and we want to come up with some working vocabulary, and working methodology, or ways that we can go about doing this as a group. Recognize that we all do this already at a kind of a pre-reflective level, but at times to come together as a group conversation, it helps to have a common vocabulary. And so Mary and I are going to split up the next 45 minutes or so and go over some basic methods in ethics, some basic terminology, so we have some common vocabulary, and then introduce one particular way to think about making ethical decisions, which will then inform the cases. We're going to use a case study approach through the week and look at some different actual cases that involve ethical decision making to inform that.
We have a lot of material that we'll present. Most of it's written up here, and we'll be up here all week on the same sheets, so don't worry about trying to remember terms, etc. Most of them will be already familiar to you, at least in word, if not in definition. So we encourage you not to be overwhelmed.
We want to emphasize again and again that these are, what we're going to do today is meant to give us common tools, not to make anybody feel inadequate. They are the kinds of things that all of us are already doing all the time, but ethicists, like every other thing, group, has a way of formulating their own jargon. So we're going to work with some of that jargon and hopefully make it a little more familiar with you. One way of thinking about ethics, and this came out certainly in the list of things we brainstormed here, is to think of it happening on at least four different levels. Probably the most common level is what we call the gut level or the feeling level. When you're faced with something that forces you to stop and think about how does this affect my values, all of us will have gut feelings about that. And one example of that might be, if you see a person who's suffering, your immediate response might be, I hate to see needless suffering, and I need to do something about it. That's kind of a gut level, feeling level response to that. And that's one that all of us share and encounter all the time in our daily life. It informs many of the decisions that we make. Moving, and each of these moves to another level of complexity or deeper conscious reflection. A second level would be what we call the moral level, and this is one that came up here in the very beginning. What is right and what is wrong? This is the whole level. It has a feeling of oughtness to it. I ought to do this because it's right, or I ought not to do it because it's wrong. And so looking at some of the issues that we'll be discussing this week having to do with healthcare, if you were to say, I ought not to prolong his or her dying process because, that's a decision you're making at a moral level, bringing in a question of right or wrong or oughtness to it. Now, ethics is the next step of taking our intuitions at the moral level and making them more systematic, making them more into a formal reflection or formal system of ways that we make decisions in order to bring about consistency and coherency to our decision-making process. And so at the ethical level, we begin to ask questions like, why, what is truth, and why ought I to tell the truth? Beginning to ask more of the philosophical questions or the faith questions that begin to inform our decision making. And so you might say, for example, in this question about whether or not I ought to prolong his or her dying process, you might say, one of the principles or one of my values is a commitment to quality of life. Therefore, when I take that value to this situation, here's how it helps me to decide what to do here. You're moving into the area of ethics then, when you start to identify principles or values that you hold and how those inform the way you act in a situation. And finally, and also important for our discussion here, is what ethicists call the post-ethical level. I would call it probably more the faith or the theological level. Mm-hmm. And that is, how do our faith commitments inform the kinds of ethical decisions we make? Now, ethics as a system is meant to, the principles that are put about by ethicists are usually thought meant to be rational ones that any human being could be expected to uphold, such as honesty is a positive value. That's why you don't have to be a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or an atheist to uphold. Generally, people across the spectrum would hold that as an acceptable ethical value. But since this is a community of reflection taking place in a faith community, we want to acknowledge that there's another level that will inform our decisions. That's a faith level. Now, if we can go, and I'm going to ask Mary to keep poking me in the side if I end up talking too long. We're going to work through this pretty quickly. I want to just simply introduce some basic terms and vocabulary, many of which are already on our board here. What I want to do is give us a common vocabulary so as we use these during the week, and again, we will leave this up here so we have a chance to be reflecting back on it. I don't know about you folks, but I always come to this discussion going, I have a sense of what morality is, I have a sense of what ethics is, I think I know what a duty or a responsibility is, but never clear about that. So we thought we'd start off just being clear. Morality, like we said, deals with the question of right or wrong. It deals with choices and behaviors that we would classify as right or wrong. And if you think of morality as that sense of the oughtness, it's where we get moralistic from somebody you interact with who says it feels oughtness to everything. We tend to say that going overboard, but morality in its general sense deals with choices and behaviors that we can classify as right or wrong. Ethics, then, as we said, is the systematic formulation of moral principles, rules, or standards. That is, these are values, principles, rules, or standards that give us guidance into what's right or wrong and how to then those shape our behavior. And an ethical issue, then, is in the broadest sense, any course of action that affects, and I put in here human well-being with the human in brackets. Most ethicists work in the area of human interaction, so they would simply say any course of action affecting human well-being. Later on in the week, we're going to want to expand that context a little bit to think about other forms of life, animal life and so forth, that would also fall in the area of being ethical. But if you just think of ethical issues, and this would be one that Cindy brought up in the balcony, any course of action between us that affects human well-being. So this operates at many levels. Again, please stop me at any point if this is not clear, if I'm moving too quickly. A value is any deeply held belief or commitment. And these oftentimes then shape our actions, our choices. But important to know that a value can be both positive or negative. We tend to think of them as being a positive value, but there are cases where you can have negative values as well. There's simply any deeply held belief or commitment. An example of a deeply held negative, what I would consider negative value, would be forms of bigotry, either racism or sexism. They can be deeply held values, but they interact negatively when we try and do ethics. Now, a right, you'll oftentimes hear about rights when we talk about ethics. I have the right to this, or her rights are protected. A right is a justified claim to something which others must respect. These can take place in the legal framework. If you think about our constitutional rights, the right to assembly, the right to free speech, so forth, those are justified claims that society recognizes all people must respect. When we talk about some of the healthcare and biomedical issues this week, there will be rights such as the right to informed consent that will be important as we discuss these things. And the flip side of a right is a duty. A duty is an obligation that's held either by individuals or by institutions that you're expected to perform. And they oftentimes relate to another person's rights. Example of this for an institution in the legal area, everyone has a right to legal representation in a fair trial. Our government has the duty and the responsibility to provide legal counsel in those situations. So rights and duties oftentimes go hand in hand. Responsibility is related to duty, but it's a little bit broader. It's defined as a task or an area for which an individual or an institution is accountable. Now, if you think of this, for example, with parents, parents have the responsibility for the well-being of their children. That entails many specific duties, but the responsibility covers a whole broad area of which the circumstances may change, and the parents have to adapt to that. Okay, these are many of the kind of background definitions. What we're going to be interested in is how these intersect to create ethical dilemmas or ethical problems that then we need to engage each other with to come up with the right response. An ethical dilemma is simply defined when a situation where ethical values, principles, or actions conflict. So you can think of, for example, very quickly, one, if you have sworn secrecy to a friend who's asked you to keep confidential some information, you later learn that by keeping that information confidential, something may happen which is harmful. You're faced with an ethical dilemma. Do you protect confidentiality? Do you protect the power? Do you act so that prevent harm? These are two different values which are now in conflict, and you're forced to decide. That's what we mean by an ethical dilemma. And the case studies that we're going to work with this week will have one or more ethical dilemmas involved in them.
Usually more.
Ethical theory, then, is simply the process by which we justify a particular ethical decision. We come up with ethical theories, and we're going to talk about them in just a minute, what they are, in order to provide consistency and coherence about how we resolve ethical dilemmas. And you'll see that they basically fall into one of two camps, and you can think about how you operate yourself as to which one you use more when we go over them. But the ethical theory is, again, a system which helps provide guidance and consistency when we come to ethical dilemmas. The last thing I just want to mention, because they'll come up a little bit later in the week, is the difference between intrinsic value and instrumental value. Now, intrinsic value says that a person or a being has value for its own sake. Doesn't matter what they do or who they are, just by being a human being, in this case, they are valuable for their own sake. And intrinsic value is the fundamental assumption that informs all of ethics. We ask questions about rightness and wrongness because all of us have intrinsic value. But there are other times when we have to make ethical decisions where the question of instrumental value also comes in. And that is our value for the sake of others. I'll give one very brief illustration, because oftentimes we shy away from making judgments of instrumental value. We shy away from thinking of people as means rather than ends in themselves. But one very quick value case. There was one organ available and two people who needed it. One was a very bright academician, a single man who had a brilliant career in the university. The other was a laborer who was a father of five children and a husband. And the hospital was forced to decide between the two of these people, who presumably had equal intrinsic value, who was going to get the organ. They eventually decided, based on instrumental value, that the man who was the father to five children and a husband had more instrumental value to people immediately affected, and he was the one who got the organ. Now, we could come back and debate the rightness or wrongness of that, but that shows you, I just simply want to use an illustration of how both intrinsic value and instrumental value can inform the decisions we have to make.
That was an ethical dilemma.
That was an ethical dilemma. And that's one of the case studies we're going to focus on is healthcare in an age of scarce resources. scarce monetary resources, scarce global resources, scarce organs, those kinds of things. Before I move on to Mary now, let me just ask if there's any questions or clarification just on this list here. Again, we'll keep this posted. The important thing is not that you know these terms so much, it's that when we talk about these things, that they, each of the ideas that are involved in these terms come into the conversation.
Good. Would you want me to do these terms and then you come back to the...
Yeah, why don't we do that?
Do you want to pull it off, Tom?
Yeah.
I did it for you. Okay. Now, I get, in some ways, a little bit of the easier assignment right now, which is to talk about some fairly commonly used terms, particularly in biomedical ethics, but certainly used in a lot of other ethical arenas. Yeah.
Let me just mention, there are a lot of chairs available over here if people want to come
feel free.
And sit
we're,
down.
We're informal. You can tell that Spencer is much more a J than Carlson. His is a much neater poster here. But let's go through these fairly quickly.
No, it's just that Carlson has a baby.
Carlson has a baby. She works faster. That's right. Yes, yeah. Okay. Some of the basic ethical principles used commonly across literature and ethics and certainly practice. And I should just ask, how many of you do medicine things, nursing, medical social work position? Okay. Probably have some good experience in here. Respect for persons is what Dan mentioned sort of as the fundamental underlying ethical principle, which says that persons have intrinsic value, persons may be seen as ends and not means, and it's commonly referred to as the sanctity or dignity of life. So that value or principle really underlies all others. It means that worth doesn't depend on usefulness, socioeconomic status, color, age, anything like that. It's difficult sometimes in our society in the United States to remember this and to talk about it, and that'll come out in some of our case studies. The second is not as commonly known as a term, non-maleficence. It means do no harm, essentially. Written into the Hippocratic Oath after some revisions of the oath happened down the road, but do no harm. And I was saying, isn't Cinderella's, one of her stepsisters, maleficence? I couldn't remember, but it sort of came to me as I was preparing this, I don't know. Does never intend directly to harm or kill somebody. Third is autonomy, very important concept, and we'll talk about it a lot. Also sometimes referred to as self-determination, which says that because human beings have intrinsic value and worth, they ought to be given the right to choose how to live their own lives. That can also be discussed in great detail, I think, in the United States. We have some issues with that. It implies, as Dan mentioned briefly, the notion of informed consent. We have to know what it is we're choosing between or about in life. It also implies something that will come up later, something called decision-making capacity, commonly referred to as competence, that in order to choose freely what we want to do with our lives, we have to be, quote, competent to do that. And we'll talk about what that means down the road. It's also important to caution that in the United States, often autonomy takes on primary or absolute value that says this is it. People have the right to choose no matter what else happens or no matter what it does to anybody else. Most ethicists, I would say, and certainly Dan and me, would talk about the importance of the relationality of autonomy, which says that I should have the right to choose or decide for myself as long as I take into consideration what effect it might have on other people in my life. Okay. Confidentiality also comes from the initial respect for persons, which says because people have intrinsic worth and value, individuals should have control over information which is private about them. And other people ought not to have the right to give that information away, particularly if that information can be harmful about somebody. Honesty, simply do not deceive others. That certainly might come up in biomedical ethics when we talk about truth-telling on the part of physicians, particularly, or maybe nurses. Is it always right to tell the truth to patients? That may come up at some point here. Fidelity says, do not betray trust. It says, keep your promises, keep your contracts with people in your lives. The two are obviously related. Justice, along with autonomy and respect for persons, is one of the sort of top three or basic three ethical principles in much of ethics writing. It's very complicated, but essentially talks about three major principles. Equality says similar persons ought to be treated in similar ways. We'll come back to that. Similar persons ought to be treated in similar ways. Generally, that refers to non-discrimination. A person should not be treated differently in a specific situation because of some irrelevant characteristic. Okay? Reciprocity simply says people should be given what is their due. Whatever is people's rights is their due, they ought to be given that. And third, equity talks about the distribution of resources, both burdens and benefits in society ought to be done equitably. Not equally, but equitably, which says that those who need more deserve more. It's a basic justice concept. So we'll talk about that probably in terms of the organ transplantation case example we have, and maybe in terms of a number of others. Beneficence is related clearly to non-maleficence, which says instead of simply doing no harm, acting always to promote the whole well-being of another person. The critical concept here is whole. Holistic means acting to promote the psychological, social, spiritual, moral, economic well-being besides physical well-being, which will become very important as we go along. So beneficence says promote whole well-being. Utility is very commonly understood. Do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Utilitarian concept. Fairly clear and straightforward. Last but certainly not least, and one that will come up probably in each of our case examples, is the notion of burden and benefit. Burden benefit is judged in relation to a person's total well-being, again, but from the person's point of view, his or herself. What is it that we think that person would view as a burden or a benefit in terms of treatment or in terms of decisions? This used to be called, for many of you would be familiar with ordinary versus extraordinary treatment or means. You may have heard that. It came, I think, out of Catholic theological ethics. This is much more used now because burden benefit places the emphasis on the person being affected. Ordinary, extraordinary really talked about what you were doing or not doing to the person. It focused on the means instead of the person as an end. Does that make some sense? So it's actually been found by most people to be much more helpful than this notion of extraordinary treatment, partly because treatment gets more and more extraordinary all the time, certainly in the Western countries and particularly in the United States. So, stop there for a minute. Anything unclear about those? We're zipping. It's for you.
We should lay aside just so Mary's and my, our ethical, but not an ethical dilemma, our dilemma for this session was we realized we had a lot of material to cover, but we didn't want you all to fall asleep since it's a warm afternoon. So we're going to try and get through it so we can get into the interesting part, which is conversing together about it. Yeah.
Well, I think the question I don't really want to open discussion, but are you asserting that these 10 things you wrote down here are self-consistent?
No, and this is the part, that's actually quite a good lead into the next thing I'm going to talk about. That there are at least two different logics involved here on these principles, and they shape different ways to approach ethics. So I want to talk about it in just a moment. Before we get into that, these basic principles, when they come into conflict, that's what we're defining as an ethical dilemma. When there's either a lack of consistency or a conflict between one or two or more of these, then you have a dilemma that needs to be resolved.
These also are just a few of ethical principles that exist. These are sort of the most commonly used in my experience and in much of the biomedical ethics literature. We can certainly add some and may well through the other principles.
But I just wanted to just check and see. My guess is that for most of us here, most of these, if you take out the names of them, the definitions are pretty familiar. Most of us are familiar with things like it's wrong to intentionally harm someone, right, an innocent person. That gets called non-maleficence, but most of us grow up with that as just a given in our culture. Many of these are very strong in our culture. Some are weighted more heavily than others. And what naming them does is gives us a way to talk to each other about them. What I'd like to do is follow up on your question now and just briefly introduce us to three basic models for ethics. Or in some ways, they're really more the logic of the way you do ethics. And what's important as we do this is to pay attention to the assumptions and the logic and not so much the terminology, because this is where some of the ethical terms get a little bit heavy. There are two fundamental paradigms, and I'll write them here. You may not be able to see, but I'm just going to jot a few words here. One of which is called consequentialism. Now, is anyone familiar with this, or would anyone guess what is important about this way of doing ethics? It's sort of inherent in the name there. Okay, now here it ends. Someone else said consequences. This basically is the logic that you begin any ethical situation by examining what it is, and that will guide you as you decide what to do in your ethics. This is the area that tends to be when people tend to look out for the social welfare of the whole community. And this is when Mary mentioned that the greatest good for the greatest number, that's utility. That is an example of consequentialism, where you're examining what are the likely outcomes for the individual and the community, and then make your judgments based on that. And consequentialism tries to maximize human welfare. Now, the other one that is sort of opposite to consequentialism in its logic, and this is, as somebody mentioned, pays attention to the ends. What are the ends of this act? What are the likely outcomes? The other one that is common, and this goes by several different names, if we can bring them up, we want to, but consequentialism is a good basic one. The other one, which I find kind of a mouthful, but it's deontological ethics, or deontologicalism, which, if you were thinking the opposite, or a different logic of thinking the consequences, deontological pays attention to the means.
You left down a couple of letters on it.
What did I leave? Deontological. How's that? As I said, it's a mouthful, I didn't get it all out. Deontological ethics, or you might want to call it means-oriented ethics, is sometimes also called absolutist ethics. Because this way of thinking says that there are certain behaviors and principles which are fundamental, certain obligations and duties which are inviolable. It doesn't matter what the outcome is. An example of this would be stealing is always wrong. All right? So when you think deontologically, you look at the different means that are involved there without regard to the outcome. And it says the logic behind this is that even if you could justify a positive consequence in the short term, that in the long term, if you get in the habit, you know, it's the slippery slope argument. If you allow stealing in one incident or lying in one incident, then you lose your moral ability to draw distinctions, and therefore, in the long term, it's unethical to allow violations of these basic duties and principles. Now, those are sort of the two different logics involved, and what I want to come back to now is just take a look at the logics of the principles here, because as you may have picked up, the first seven are all what we would call basically deontological in their logic. These are making statements that in all situations, these are principles that have to be respected regardless of the outcome. So you always respect the person. You never do harm intentionally regardless of the outcome. You cannot harm an innocent human being for the greater good of someone else. All of these first seven would have that kind of logic informing them. The last three, though, 8, 9, and 10, if you think about them, are consequentialist in their logic. They're looking at what are the consequences. Therefore, it's not enough just to do no harm intentionally. We must actively promote the whole well-being because of the likely consequences. Or utility, we already lifted up, is the greatest good for the greatest number. Or the whole question of burden benefit. All of these are evaluated by their probable consequences and how that will shape that. Now, there is a third area, and it's actually the area that Mary and I work most in, which is called, appropriately enough, a mixed or a contextual approach, which says there are important contributions of both of these, but sticking to one model to the exclusion of the other one becomes too narrow. It keeps you too narrowly defined in any kind of situation and isn't helpful for doing that. And we're going to come back and work through that a little bit. But I wanted to stop and just give you an example of a little bit of the logic of consequentialism and deontological. Basically, if you find that you tend to work out of consequentialism if you find that when one of these are in conflict with each other, that you tend to resolve it using the utilitarian principle. This may violate autonomy, and it may violate one of the others, but what we're going to do then is look for the greatest good for the greatest number. And since we can't resolve it perfectly, we'll look for the best welfare.
you're probably then operating with this kind of logic. The other one would be, it may be that these two are, these values are in conflict, but the important thing is to resolve it so that you don't violate any of the principles themselves and don't regard the outcome as much. Let me just stop here. We'll have a chance to work through these as we go through the week, but we want to just give some language to that, and we'll be pointing out examples as we talk to each other, how we think about them. And you may want to think about your own way, the ways you look at things, issues, ethical issues, about how you approach them. Any questions or things that are not clear on this?
Good, right bunch.
You want to add anything here?
Nope.
What we'd like to do for the remainder of the time here is to just introduce briefly one model for ethical decision making that we're going to use this week, and then walk through a case study that Mary has put together that illustrates some of these steps. So I'm going to just very briefly introduce this, and then we'll spend most of the time walking through it. This particular model has two different steps in it that are both important when we come to thinking about making ethical decisions. The first one is what we call the analysis of the situation. And this is common to many, many different fields. Ethics is also one. That in order to do any good thinking about something, you need to have a good analysis that informs it. And so there are three steps that inform this. The first is to gather the relevant facts or information that are pertinent to the case. And this has to do with a number of different areas. It can have to do with in our case, medical issues, knowing enough about the different nuances, for example, the difference between being HIV positive and having AIDS. There are differences and they affect in that, or being brain dead and being in a permanent vegetative state. So it means being informed enough on the actual situation that will inform you correctly. But it also means knowing enough about the people involved and the particular nature of who's involved, what their wishes and desires are, that you can adequately go into the situation. Once the relevant facts and information has been gathered, then it's important to identify which the ethical issue or the ethical dilemma. That is, to stop and think which of these principles are in conflict with each other. Because it helps you then to narrow down to where the dilemma is located and to highlight what are the conflicts there in order to know how to begin to resolve it. And once you've located the issues in the dilemma, the third step in this then is to begin to generate alternatives to this. What are some different possibilities for resolving this? And then ask, what are the consequences of each of these alternatives? So you may come up with three or four different possibilities. You'll see this in the case we walked through. And then begin to think, what are the consequences of each one? Both the good and the bad consequences, and the short-term and long-term consequences. All of this is part of the analysis of the situation. It's preliminary to actually getting into the ethical evaluation. From there, we move into the second step, which is called the moral assessment. Once you've gotten clear on the situation, then you first begin to assess the alternatives and the consequences that you've come up with in light of the relative values and principles. If we follow alternative A, what does it mean about respect for autonomy? Or is it going to mean violating confidentiality? If so, how do we justify that? So you begin to assess these in light of the ethical principles. And a step towards the end then is to begin to assess the underlying motives in light of the relevant values and principles. This simply recognizes that any given action may be positive or negative depending on the context, and motive is part of that. I'll give you a very simple example. You turning off the life support system. In one situation, you may be doing it to relieve the suffering of the patient. In the second situation, you may be doing it in order to get the inheritance from the patient more quickly. It's the very exact same action, but the motive informing that action tells you, can inform whether or not that's an ethical decision. And finally then, after you've assessed these and assessed your motives, you then finally have to choose an alternative and at that point seek to justify it. Tell why you think it's the best alternative.
The important thing about this model, and it's one of, again, many models, I've seen models with 10 steps, I've seen models with 15 steps, is that this is what's often used in bioethics committees at hospitals and increasingly in nursing homes, to see that decisions are carefully thought through. This is not something each of you is going to sit down with your spouse or your children or your parents and say, now, okay, have we identified the ethical issue? Now, in light of all the principles, but if you've thought about it ahead of time, then if the time and when the time comes that you need to think about either a daily interaction or a primary ethical dilemma in your family, you at least will think about some of these things coming back. Now, that's what we'd like to do most of the rest of the week, is have you look at some real life case examples, some of which will probably hit fairly close to home with a number of us. We recognize that emotions may run fairly high with this kind of case study, so at the end of each session we're going to allow some time for debriefing feelings about how it was to talk about certain cases that may have been close to people with whom you were familiar. Let me just go over very simply a complicated case, but we're going to make it very simple. I'm going to read it. It's about three sentences. And then Dan and I, with your help, I think, because we have some time, we'll go through some of the steps. I think we can get some feedback from folks. So let me just read it.
And this, again, is just to be illustrative of how the model can work in one situation.
And starting tomorrow, people will talk about this in groups, etc. So it won't always be this, this model of education. Okay, a baby boy is born 2 months prematurely at a hospital in a small town in Minnesota. Happens to be where I'm from. Probably half of you. His parents are farmers with four other children. His lungs have not developed, therefore causing severe brain damage. The doctor gives his parents the choice of medical intervention which would keep him alive, or no intervention which would result in his death due to respiratory failure. The parents call you, their minister. What would you advise them to decide? Not an uncommon situation. Some of us know of some famous cases sort of related to this kind of situation. Often ministers are the second person after a physician who is called upon in a professional capacity to help advise parents in this kind of situation. So we're just going to take each step, and I'm going to ask for some feedback here. Initially, if you have that much information, what other relevant facts would you as the minister want to ask about what's going on here? That's all the parents have told you.
If the child can live with intervention, like how much intervention, how long that intervention would take.
Okay, what is the intervention? Are we talking about a life on a respirator? Or is there potential that this child's lungs might develop to a point where he can live on his own without a respirator? Will he always need oxygen at home, or will he need other sorts of treatments? And how long might that last, and at what cost, emotional and financial, to him? Okay, good. Other things you want to know as a minister. Yeah.
Maybe you want to find out if the parents are ready for the responsibility and the commitment it's going to take on their part.
Yeah, you might want to sit down and talk to the parents a bit. How is this really going to affect your life? The farm, four other children. Have you insurance? Are you able to financially consider taking care of this child? As the minister, you might have some knowledge about the faith stance of these parents, but you might also want to ask, what is your belief about life and death, particularly for a child? That gets into sort of quality of life issues, which people differ a great deal on. It may be that the parents disagree about either the specific readiness or their faith stance about that. One thing I should say about gathering relevant information is in an information age, particularly in our culture, we always want more. At some point, a decision has to be made. We can't like wait for every single piece to come in. Plus, in a situation like this, technically speaking, sooner or later, we have to decide whether to put the child on a respirator, which probably means moving the child to a big city, far away from this small town. And we can't wait to see if lungs will develop on their own or how long it might be. Some of those answers are unknown, but good questions to be asking.
Mary, can I ask with something like that, how long would you have to decide? Not very, like minutes, right?
Probably minutes to hours. Yeah. Medical people know for sure, for sure. In this particular situation, like hour to 2 hours, this family had. So it's quick. It's the middle of the night, the baby's born, they call a minister up. And that's the more realistic. We don't have like all day to sort of go back and think about this over dinner. It's a good point. The other thing to understand or try to have some knowledge about is what the laws are in your particular state or the court cases about who gets to decide. Generally speaking, courts still say that parents have the ultimate right to decide about children who are born severely disabled. That's been challenged in many court cases, however. Baby Doe was the primary one that said the state has a compelling interest to overrule the rights of the parents to decide something about a disabled infant. So we're unsure in this country what to do. But still, this decision is made all the time with docs, parents, and sometimes a minister, sometimes a social worker. Okay, secondly, what is the ethical dilemma or issue here? How would you term it in terms of these principles? What's at stake? What's in conflict here?
Number one, respect for persons.
Okay, respect for persons. This individual boy's sanctity and dignity of life, right?
Number three.
Okay, number three is?
Right.
Autonomy. Okay, you bring up a good point here. Now, can this little boy decide for himself what he wants? Obviously not. So who decides? Something called surrogate decision makers. Who decides in the event that somebody does not have the decision-making capacity because of illness or because of age or mental status? In this case, it would be the parents, generally speaking, but that is being challenged in many, many court cases. So you might have this. I don't know that these two are in conflict particularly, but what might be in conflict with one of those?
Justice.
Justice? Say more, yeah.
Well, the resources you'd be using for prolonging life or whatever may be better used in another circumstance or whatever.
Okay.
Where you distribute the resources you have.
Yeah, so what if this boy has to be on a respirator, literally, the rest of his life? Couldn't that money, that cost, which is going to eventually be you and me paying, because nobody can afford that under their insurance or without insurance, except in rare situations, couldn't that cost be, or that money be better used for 50 or 100 children who are born to impoverished mothers, for
instance?
Could
that be utility then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But also in a smaller sense, it could be utility within a small family too. They might have to say, geez, we have four kids, there's a lot of money.
What about those other kids? That's right. What if we spend all our emotional time and energy and our financial resources on one kid?
Because obviously, you brought up a case in 2 seconds, and we told us there were four kids.
Uh-huh.
That has to be an ethical issue. It's like us, you tell us
that. It's part of the relevant information.
That's
yeah.
Right.
And that brings up both justice, but also this whole thing of burden benefit. You know, you look at the individual, but you also look at who the individual affects.
Right. And then in the same burden benefit, if we're looking at this little boy's total well-being, and the parents believe that being in heaven or with God is as good as or better than anyone, even a healthy, good, productive, if you will, life, then is it in that boy's total well-being to keep him alive on the respirator? So another place we might be in common.
I just mentioned this to Maria about children born in Latin America and other parts of the world. Number 7 would come into question.
Mm-hmm.
People have to, they die all the time.
Not even
children.
An issue. All right. This isn't even a discussion in many parts of the world. There's not an option for
ethics.
Intervention.
But
I wouldn't say that, but yeah.
Well, what I would bring it up is back to your point about the justice question, too. Justice implies you've got some framework or context, and generally we tend to have a fairly reduced context. We think about the community, we may think about the state, we may think about the country. We rarely go beyond the country. But in terms of you bringing up the issue of reciprocity of resources, if we can project that it's going to take $1 to $2 million in the first 5 years to keep this infant alive, what about children in Peru or children in India? If we expand the context, Is it ethical to allocate that amount of money to keep a brain-damaged infant alive, given a world context? Or do you keep it reduced to a state context or a community context?
Or the family.
You know, these are the kind, and I'm not saying there is a rightness or wrongness to a lot of these answers, but these are the kind of questions you end up having to grapple with. And you can see how these principles now begin to come in conflict with each other, depending on how you set up the context.
And your point of view.
Yeah.
Because, for example, I remember when the Kurds over in Iraq, when they had 9, 10 kids, they were having kids die every day. My gosh, I would die if one of my kids died. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was just became a part of the life for a year there. And what she brought up, can you imagine that, having your kids die? I mean, we can't imagine that. We are fortunate.
Why don't I do the third and let you do the last three? How about that? Okay. The third one is generate alternatives and consequences, keeping in mind both short and long-term consequences. What are the alternatives here in this particular case that you can see? Sort of two basic. Hmm?
Yeah.
Two cases. Death and life.
Yeah. Do nothing, and a child will die. I mean, it's pretty clear without lungs, born at 7 months, the child will die. Maybe an interim thing, and I don't know enough about lung development in newborns, but it could be that you could give this child oxygen for a while, and then it would probably just live a little longer and then die, because you do need lungs eventually. Or you do medical intervention, which in this case, as I said, is probably move the child to a city hospital, probably have the child on a respirator, could be for who knows how long. Short-term and long-term benefits there? Or go ahead before we go there.
I think you need to rule in one of the long-term consequences or benefits is a perfectly healthy baby, perfectly healthy child.
Rule in as a possibility. These days, that's an absolute possibility.
It's especially, it's very possible in the scenario we presented. Mm-hmm. That's not a very premature baby anymore.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe we should have made it five months. That would have been 20 weeks. Would have been the best. Yeah.
There is,
thank you.
There's
that's why we get
no option.
That's right. We get nurses in the audience. It's a better way to go. No, that's a good point. So there is a long-term possible consequence of this child doing just fine, being, however, severely mentally disabled.
There would be no way you'd know that in a 32-weeker.
Right, except that this doctor said
we
that.
We don't know that, though.
This doctor's in a small town, and he said, you're right.
Okay.
Right. That's why I put it in here. Most doctors in small towns, I'm going to make a generalization here, many would not say that they know that for sure. And many would say, geez, we got to get a specialist in right now, but you need to say whether you want me to do that. Otherwise, my experience is that this child won't do well and will have severe disability. But I appreciate that. This child could also well come out of it and be just fine.
Although there's some equation here with the small town and these, a third world country.
Yeah, good point. That was not even considered as I wrote this directly.
Is that, he doesn't know, they don't have the resources. People don't know. We're in a big city. No, more and more of these babies are surviving.
Mm-hmm. For people who have insurance.
For people who have insurance.
And have one or two parents who are intelligent enough to ask the questions and sort of push and get two or three opinions and bring folks in. And
the obvious one of the relevant facts. You get some statistics on that probably. And
yeah,
eventually, you know one out of five of these kids can make it or whatever.
Right. And if this child did survive and do real well, maybe you can tell us, might that be a year process or a 6 month process or a 2 year process? We don't know.
If you want to stay with the case scenario of a baby that's born 2 months early, that puts your chances of having a baby out at the hospital by the time of his due date is real good, and having a good baby with very little sequelae from it. I mean, that's where the medical practice is now.
Where?
Again, United States, big cities.
In the United States.
For insurance.
Everywhere in the United States.
Well, not in small towns.
No, but they would be transported. And
right.
There isn't
right.
A
via helicopter
big city that doesn't transport a baby. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're talking about fairly a possible short-term consequence of really good then.
Now, what do you want to do with your scenario? I'm getting confused.
Well, I'm keeping the scenario right where I am, but we also
okay, so we've got additional input here to your scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first scenario I was doing real well with.
You wait. This is a simple one. Yeah.
But I want to point out one thing. We're still in this analysis of the situation. We're still in gathering relevant information, and this is not at all atypical. In fact, anybody who covers the medical field, I mean, it's changing daily. Weekly, daily, monthly. I mean, I'm really interested in your input. My mother is a neonatologist, a pediatrician who follows premature babies and child development, and her interest is what happens in the first 2 to 3 years following crisis intervention on these, mm-hmm. because often then you get into the whole question of short-term, medium-term, long-term, cost-benefit, damage, so forth, the point that we're making just in terms of illustrating it is this is the kind of information and debate and dialogue that goes on simply at the point of trying to analyze the situation before we even started getting to assessing the ethical decisions there.
I would say you don't have, pardon me for being up here, I would say you don't have enough information. I'm leaping to the end of the line here. I don't think you have enough information from the resources you have in that setting to make a negative decision. See, I'm saying,
okay,
it sounds to me like we're varying between, we have possibilities. Now, if you were presenting this to the family members, that this with an intervention might become a totally normal child in 2 years. The minute you say that, you're calling a helicopter.
We may have, and we may need to return, even though, as you pointed out, maybe the way we set the case up is not totally realistic. One of the ways that we were setting it up is that there's a high degree of certainty of significant brain damage. Now, you're pointing out that nowadays, with this kind of intervention, that's no longer a high degree of certainty. But that was part of the givenness we were giving to this one in terms of making the decision on that. So,
and it was what this family was told by this doctor.
Yeah.
And this family did not ask to go further, did not say, let's check with another doctor, or let's look at some studies, or let's call a nurse in a neonatal intensive care unit.
What is illustrated above is that ethical decision making, you work with the information you have. And as Mary is pointing out, we always want more, and usually more is better. I mean, usually having more access to information is helpful, is better, but we don't always have it. And so what you do then is work with the information you have to come up with the best decisions that you've got.
I guess my point is, you can't make a negative decision with this sparse and incomplete information.
Negative meaning let the child die?
Yeah.
This family did, though.
Yeah.
So
I
many
know.
Family do. I think, yeah.
Who can speak for himself?
Yeah. Yeah. Make a good decision. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, are you saying you can't make an
better.
Ethical decision?
Well, I see the problem. Okay, I'm just using your
sure.
guidelines.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me you are at level one, you're just have inadequate information to go to level two. And
but you're
when
just trying
you
to
get more information, it would be to have the baby go to the center and have the analysis done.
You're just trying to demonstrate how it all works.
We don't have a lot of time.
Specifics.
Well, the question
is
that
going to the center wouldn't be necessarily good. I mean, the kid could be transported to the center in a helicopter. You'd have your specialist come in. You get the other opinions. And then you're ready to go on
okay.
to the other.
Well, we're going to need to stop in just a minute. But maybe you raise a lot of very good questions. And this is precisely what we're going to engage in as we work through these cases during the week. Maybe we can just simply give you the scenario, the outline, and how the family chose to decide about that.
Can I say one thing
yeah.
just quickly? My wife's family roughly faced this question. They're Christian farmers, southern Minnesota, and I can tell you they would let the baby die in a second.
And my parents faced it, and they did too.
Yeah, that's just the way they think. It's the reverence for life and animals and the Christian faith. It's not a question. This is kind of yuppie talk, which is fun, and I like it. But when you get down on the farm and they're milking cows and they're on the tractor, they view the world differently than we do. And I'm not putting farmers down or us. I'm just saying the world, they think differently. And I went into that not coming in that environment, and it's been a contrast. And so interesting how you do this case and how they think.
Yeah. What I would just do for the point of illustrating a case here is show that there are really two very different ways you could do it. And I think the way you're talking about it and the way the case was resolved really did follow that kind of, probably what I call more the consequentialist. This was a family that had a basic reverence for life, a basic trust in God, and faith that the God would take care of this baby regardless. But when faced with the probable outcome of a lifelong heavy medical intervention, brain damage, so forth, with the responsibility of raising four children, the other responsibilities have decided to not medically intervene to save the child's life. That's a consequentialist kind of one. But there are other situations where the family felt equally strongly that the fundamental value that was at stake here was preserving life at all costs, that God had given them this life, and therefore what their primary responsibility to do was to, at all costs, preserve this life. And therefore they took what we call the deontological, the absolute one, which means preserve life at all costs, and said, take it to the hospital, do the intervention. And all I'm saying is you can justify both of them ethically, but they work from different premises. And I think you were moving more from the second one, possibly, in terms of with the degree of information you have to bias it in favor of preserving the life of the child.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Just sort of a, I don't know, maybe mechanical question. Isn't it frequently, if you do choose to have an intervention, it's much more difficult at that point to have it removed?
Yes.
Like, you can't say, okay, I want 4 more hours to think about this.
Ethically, they're the same notion. Yeah. Yes, to begin treatment.
You kind of have to continue it.
And then remove it. It's ethically similar as not starting it in the first place, but emotionally, incredibly much more difficult.
Well,